Krasinski. Shh. This is Arnie, co-host of Now Playing.
Stuart.
You killed us all!
Yeah, don't worry about that, Stuart. I got my hose running outside so the aliens can't hear us. This is Jacob.
Thank God. Yeah, we definitely need to find a place somewhere where we can thank our platinum donors because they went above and beyond to hear us talk about a movie that's bigger than I had realized.
I did not realize how much money this movie made.
Yeah, 188 domestic is huge. It was the 15th biggest movie of 2018 and the biggest horror movie of that year, if you don't count Jurassic World, Forgotten Kingdom, and Venom.
No, I don't count those as horror.
No. I count one of them as horrible, but I don't count them as horror. This was a huge movie. I remember it coming out, and I thought it looked a little gimmicky from the trailers and whatnot, but the reviews were so good that in April of the year it came out, 18, Stuart, you, I, and Marjorie went to New York in April because of Scarface's anniversary, and we went to see the talk with Al Pacino and things. And one day, it was raining, Marjorie and I didn't know what to do. We decide, in New York, let's go see A Quiet Place. We've heard so much about it. So down in Midtown, we go and see this in theaters. And that was not a quiet place. The people behind us had so much candy that they were rattling the whole damn movie.
Yeah, I didn't see it with you, but I also had a theatrical experience. And it is going to make you very self-conscious to be in a public place. Every popcorn munch, every rattle of the box, every slurp from your straw, everyone in the theater knows how much you're eating. So you better be okay with that.
I read a headline that said concession stand sales were really down from this movie because people kept complaining about crunching of popcorn. I was really happy. Marjorie and I didn't even have a drink. You know, fuck Manhattan prices for that shit anyway.
Yeah, I saw this one weekend of release. I saw that trailer and Emily Blunt giving birth in a bathtub as this monster arm appears. I'm like, oh, well, I got to see how that gets resolved. Like, I'm hooked. So yeah, my wife and I saw this opening weekend, and you guys are right, like, you don't realize how much noise a popcorn or milk duds even make until it's a totally quiet movie experience and you just hear every chew.
So why was it that big? I mean, do people love Jim on The Office that much? I don't think it was Krasinski or Blunt that were bringing people to the pack. It's what I think is the fact that the horror genre is one of the few places where creativity and novelty are rewarded. People will just go see a cool idea if it's a horror movie.
Do not downplay the appeal of The Office. I don't get it. People fucking love The Office, though.
I have siblings that still, like, just put it on the TV to fall asleep to every night on Netflix. But I also think it's not a family film, but it's a film about a family. I know, like, this is one of my wife's favorite movies, and I gotta think that's a big part of it because it's about parents trying to protect their children and those kind of themes, I think, does speak to people. Like, that's not something you see in horror. Usually it's teenage girls getting slaughtered and trying to save their lives. So, yeah, I think because of just that unique, you could call it a gimmick or whatever, the plot of having to be quiet and, yeah, this family dynamic, it does set it apart.
It's also PG-13, but yet it doesn't feel like a pandering PG-13
No.
That would keep me away. I went, despite it being PG-13, I will almost never go to a PG-13 horror film. I wanted to see Fantasy Island until I saw the MPAA rating. I think that it meant kids who wanted to see real horror can get into this one, and adults who normally will stay away from teen skewing horror also went to see this one. So it had a broader appeal and ticket sales than a lot of, you know, than Us or Halloween.
Sure. I think you're entirely right. But again, 188 million domestic, 350 international.
Yeah. Original concept. It's not based on a comic book. Like, that's hard to do these days.
Yeah. It's the silent movie gimmick, which was not unheard of. It should be pointed out.
Is that a pun?
It wasn't, but it is unintentional. The Artist was a silent movie that made $44 million and won Best Picture in 2012. Hush, it was a home invasion movie. It did well streaming on Netflix. I don't think its theatrical viewing was that big, but it's a really good suspense movie about a deaf and dumb writer secluded in a cabin in the woods. A masked man is trying to break in. Done by Mike Flanagan, the guy that did Dr. Sleep and Haunting of Hill House. And Don't Breathe, two summers before. I think that was the movie that made Platinum Dunes, Michael Bay, say, yep, let's make this movie. Because I don't think of Michael Bay wanting to make quiet movies.
That was the funniest thing is I know what Platinum Dunes means. I know that means Michael Bay was involved. My wife doesn't know that. So when we get to the end credits and it says executive producer Michael Bay, she flipped out. Like, she's like, he was involved with this? I can't believe he made something I liked.
Yeah. When I watched this for this review, I noticed Platinum Dunes in the opening. I just convinced myself this was Blumhouse, because if there's good horror anymore, especially original concept horror, Blumhouse is involved. So I just thought this was going to be Blumhouse. I'm like, Platinum Dunes? Okay, I love the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake, but this is the best film Platinum Dunes has touched, right?
Probably. And it should be said that what they bought and what they thought they were going to make is probably closer to Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2003. It would have been more in the wheelhouse of Platinum Dunes if they had made it like it was written. This thing was designed as a gimmick. It was two young screenwriters from Iowa who grew up on farms and said, what can we do to make our horror slasher movie stand out? And they wrote this. It was only 67 pages long. You know, usually a page a minute. That barely makes it over an hour. When you don't have dialogue, it was really short. And yeah, they basically said, Michael Bay was like, oh, that's an interesting idea. Again, I think Don't Breathe had something to do with it. And Michael Bay had just finished a movie with John Krasinski, some kind of pro-military America movie, 13 Hours.
Yeah, the Benghazi film.
Yeah, I didn't see it, but, you know, they were in communication, and Michael Bay passed him along the script, and Krasinski said, yeah, I really like it a lot, but I want to change everything. I just had my second daughter. I want to explore my fears of parenting in a dangerous age, and I will do this if you let me rewrite it, and you will let me direct it. And they'll try and figure out what Quiet Place might have been. You can get a little bit of this if you go watch Haunt, because that is a slasher movie directed by the writers of this script. They got to make a movie because they wrote A Quiet Place, Scott Beck, Brian Woods, and it is about a bunch of body modification freaks who run an extreme haunted house and terrorize a bunch of teenagers, one of which is a girl that survives because she has a history of being abused by her dad. And there are a lot of the same gimmicks in this, kind of egg timer stuff. She even steps on a nail barefoot. There's a lot of callbacks, but it feels very boilerplate. Slasher film has none of the family feeling. I think everything that we think about with this movie and the dynamics and just the mournfulness of the tone comes because Krasinski came in and said, I want to make an elevated horror movie, not a horror movie.
Okay, I take the phrase elevated horror movie and take that as meaning it's a parable, it's a metaphor, it's speaking to larger things.
Yeah.
What makes this elevated?
Oh, absolutely. It is about grief. It's ordinary people. It's much closer in tone to a family drama than it is Signs or, you know, any kind of horror movie.
I agree, but I don't think that that means it gets the elevated horror of Get Out.
I think we fight all the time about what this term means. It just means, Arnie, that
I'm
not...
good?
It means that I'm not satisfied just having people have jump scares and running around and screaming. And it doesn't mean it's good or bad. You can have shit elevated horror movies. But it meant that you had the pretensions to try and make metaphor and use the horror to speak to something that has real life dramatic consequences. This movie definitely tries to talk about guilt and death of a child issues.
I get that. I mean, that's text. That's not subtext. I guess I feel elevated horror speaks more to the subtextual language than the text.
I feel that having to be quiet and not being able to speak is a metaphor for what it feels like to feel guilty, and that this family dynamic would play out the same without the aliens. If the child had fallen off a bridge or something like that. I feel like you could have made this movie as ordinary people, and I think John Krasinski really wanted to do that. Incidentally, I don't like John Krasinski for one reason and one reason only. I've never seen The Office, at least his version. I love the BBC one with Ricky Gervais, but I've never seen him on that. I've never seen any other movie that he's done.
What else has he done?
He took my favorite author, David Foster Wallace, writer of Infinite Jest. He didn't take that book, which is my favorite book of all time. He took another one of his books and made brief interviews with hideous men, and I got through 10 minutes of it and said, whoever you think you are, I never want to see you again, because I love this writer. And David Foster Wallace, there's a reason why we haven't had a lot of movies based on his novels. He is digressive. Part of his fun is that you will be reading a paragraph, it will be footnoted, you'll go read that paragraph, it'll send you to another part of the book. It's almost like reading a choose-your-own-adventure. You'll end up flipping five different ways so far deep into it that you'll forget even where you were in the story. And that's kind of hard to do as a movie, and Krasinski fails. Or I couldn't even make it through that movie, and yeah, I never saw him again. I am an Emily Blunt fan, though. I have really enjoyed her ever since I saw her in Devil Wears Prada.
Yeah, I've realized I like her. Even if I don't like the movie, I think she's always putting in a good performance.
Yeah, Edge of Tomorrow with Tom Cruise, she stole that from him. Sicario, she's got range. You know, she can be tough, funny, or dramatic. She can do whatever it requires. And that's hard to find that. You know, I'll forgive her for Adjustment Bureau. I don't even really remember it.
Yeah.
But yeah, Looper, she wasn't a big part of.
No, like even like Girl on the Train, not a great film. I think she's great in it, though.
Yeah. I like her in the stuff I've seen her in. I mean, not everything, but she shows up enough. And I can't say I will see something because she's in it. But if I see her in it, I expect a good performance. John Krasinski, I don't know that much. I keep confusing him with Zachary Levi. I think the two look very much alike. I think the two bring similar energy. When the Smotpak commercial came on during the Super Bowl, I thought that was Zachary Levi. I didn't realize that was John Krasinski.
I am familiar with Krasinski because I did watch all of The Office, even after I should have stopped, because once Michael Scott left, it wasn't very good.
So yes, I think what we're all saying here is that these are actors that are unknown to us. And that we came to this, like a lot of people, intrigued with, can they pull this off? Can you make a movie where there's almost no dialogue and every sound that you make? I mean, silent movies are tough. I don't watch a whole lot of them myself because you need sound. You know, you want to hear what the characters think and feel. You need that dialogue. And so to remove that, it's quite a stunt. And I was curious to know if they could pull it off for a feature.
Yeah, that was part of my curiosity, too, is I went in knowing the trailers and hearing good buzz. I didn't realize how little dialogue there would be in this.
Oh.
And that they do a lot of subtitling, that they use subtitles through sign language. So there would be communication. It's not like an old school silent film where you just see lips move and sometimes the title card pops up. I mean, this is more, to me, like a foreign language film. Although, I don't want to discount the sound mixes and the things that are going on artistically with it, but as far as communication goes, you're reading most of this movie, not hearing it, and in that way, it reminds me of foreign films.
Yeah, this was Oscar nominated. It was the only Oscar nomination it got for sound design, specifically because it isn't a silent movie. I should stress the fact that you pay attention to sound because there is no dialogue. It is a largely dialogue-free movie, but sound is very important and very meaningful. It's both its absence and when those loud sounds come. It's also interesting to note, Krasinski, in directing this movie, insisted that the crew work as quietly as possible as well. Like, they came in, you know, you can imagine trying to tell people rigging the lights and all of that, shut up. They got heavy equipment and cranes and what have you, but he really wanted to pay attention to the natural sounds of where they were shooting in upstate New York. They built this farm, and he was all about, like, let's improvise. The trees, the way the wind will blow through this grass will tell us how to film this scene. And so they really did try to pay attention to, in every given moment, what it was like to be quiet there.
Yeah, just to talk about the sound, here's the hardest thing. And dealing with editing podcasts, on a small level, I can speak to this, nowhere near what they do here, but nothing is more jarring than digital silence, because that is the absence of anything. You know, that would be a tempting way to go, is just have nothing on your audio track. They can't do that here. There has to constantly be ambient sound, like there is in the real world. There has to be a breeze, or just, you can, just an aura of sound is there, because digital silence, we get it a couple of times when we go into Reagan's point of view. Reagan is a deaf character. When you go into her point of view, you hear digital silence, where there is an absence of anything on the audio track.
Yeah.
But what they do so well is have audio, on all other points of this movie when it's not her POV shot, but it sounds like silence. And as I mentioned when we did our Baby Driver podcast, I have a little bit of tinnitus. It's a side effect of medication I'm on, it turns out. It's not permanent. I could stop medicine and get rid of it.
Hey, that's great. Good to know. Yeah. I thought we had made you deaf. I actually was feeling a whole lot of guilt myself.
I actually thought it was editing podcasts had done it. No, it's a side effect of medicine.
Okay.
But when watching this movie, it makes me hyper aware of the ringing in my ears, but it doesn't block any sounds, nor does it take away from my appreciation of the sound design here. But man, when you hear nothing and yet you have a ringing in your ears, it is definitely noticeable.
Yeah. So let's talk about all the sounds and the story, what there is of it, in a plot summary, Arnie. We'll get into the movie.
It's late 2020. And we're on the 89th day of an alien invasion that has devastated the Earth. The aliens are sightless monsters that hunt solely by sound, and they seem to have no weaknesses.
I would say having no sight is a weakness, but oh yeah, I get your point.
You'd think so, but they do pretty damn well without it.
Oh, and your head is a giant ear.
And by the time this movie starts, most humans seem to be dead. In this post-apocalyptic America, we follow the Abbott family. Father Lee is an engineer, played by John Krasinski. Mother Evelyn is a doctor, played by Emily Blunt. Then they have three children. Youngest son, Beau, older son, Marcus, and their deaf daughter, Reagan. They survive by living in complete silence. But on that 89th day, Beau becomes infatuated with a space shuttle toy given to him by Reagan. And when its electronics go off and make sounds, the aliens kill Beau. On a bridge. Do you think that's a Beau Bridges reference?
Hadn't thought about it.
We jump ahead a bit over a year, and the four remaining Abbotts have holed up at a farm home living in silence. Evelyn is pregnant and near giving birth, and Reagan feels guilty over giving Beau the toy that killed him, and Reagan feels ignored by her father, who's training Marcus to hunt and survive. But Lee is also working to develop a better cochlear implant for Reagan. See, he leaves her behind not because he doesn't like or love his daughter, but because her deafness is a real weakness in this world where every sound can mean death. He gives Reagan his latest test implants, but she doesn't even want to try them after so many failures to hear a single sound. The main movie takes place when Lee and Marcus go out for training, and during that time, Reagan goes to visit the place Beau died, and Evelyn, home alone, has her water break and starts to give birth. She flips the lights to let her husband know there's a problem at home, and Marcus is tasked to set off fireworks to distract the aliens while Lee goes to help Evelyn give birth. And Marcus and Reagan end up trapped atop a grain silo where an alien attacks, but they survive when Reagan's new cochlear implant starts to squeal feedback when the alien gets close, and that sound seems to hurt the crawler. After Evelyn gives birth, Lee goes to find their other two children, and when an alien goes to kill Marcus and Reagan, Lee screams, sacrificing himself so the two children can survive. Back in the house, Evelyn is trapped with an alien. But Marcus and Reagan come, and Reagan's implant hurts the alien, so she puts it on an amplifier, and the creature starts to scream, opening its armored folds and allowing Evelyn to shoot and kill it in a weak spot. The shotgun sounds bring more creatures, but the family seem prepared to fight back with Reagan's implants and Evelyn's shotgun as credits roll.
That's how we're going to get it. You thought it was going to be coronavirus. Nope. They have a calendar in here. They have a gravesite with a year marker and all of that. I'm able to determine the day the meteors come and unleash these aliens. June 17, folks.
You say the meteors came, and that was one of the things the first time I saw this. Are these monsters that showed up from somewhere, underground, or are they aliens? But there is a newspaper article that says angels of death. So to me, yeah, that tells me they came from the sky, that they are some kind of alien creature.
I didn't see it with my own two eyes, but after doing some reading after, I did see that Lee has a lab, and there's a bunch of newspaper articles clipped up, and one of them is about a meteor that hit Earth.
Yeah, I'll walk you through it because I freeze-framed that shit. Meteor hits Mexico. Alien invasion. These are all headlines.
If only we had a wall.
Indestructible bulletproof plates, which means you can't kill them by shooting them. World powers unite to defend our planet. New York City on lockdown. Shanghai death toll in the hundreds. Psh, hundreds. National Guard, emergency evacuation. They can hear you, what you need to know to survive. Get underground, which is a sign, I think, of War of the Worlds. That was always a sign of man's decline, was that people, in order to protect themselves from the aliens, had to become subterranean. Last headline, you are on your own. So yes, you can infer the whole story through those texts. That is the way that if you want to understand what's going on. I don't know if it's essential to understand this as an alien attack or not. Because again, to me, this is a story about grief and a family processing and making the decision to try again and have another son.
Whether these beings came from the sea, from underground, if they were awakened by melting ice like Godzilla, or came in a crashing meteorite. When I first saw this, I took them as aliens. They kind of remind me of the insects from Starship Troopers. So I took it as aliens, but yeah, you don't have to know. You just have to understand you're in a monster movie, and if you can roll with that and not have it spelled out where they came from.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, we've had so many post-apocalyptic movies. I mean, at this point, it feels like a normative. I mean, with Walking Dead on TV for 10 seasons now, we have an entire generation that believes at some point they're going to have to be some kind of survivalist living out in the wilderness. This scenario feels very familiar to anyone that consumes pop culture. Day 89 tells us that this is actually September 14th, 2020, and this scene that we have was actually written as a flashback to come in the middle of the movie. They originally didn't want to tell us about how Bo died, but they ultimately, John Krasinski felt like, we need to start here. We need to see this. We don't need to tease this.
That would have been a horrible choice to tease this and leave it a mystery for the middle of the movie. This opening is everything to this movie. It sets everything up. It tells us everything we need to know. And it tells us the stakes of this movie are fucking high. This opening of the movie shocked me in ways I cannot explain.
Oh, well, do try. What specifically, they kill the kid, right?
I mean,
we got, but they always kill the kid. Like, you should really get over that.
I know, but he's such a cute kid. It's a PG-13 movie. It's about a family. To start with the death of the child and have it kind of be the sister's fault in a way, you can look at it that way. It just let me know the stakes of this movie were high, and anybody could die in this movie. If you're going to start by killing the kid, you could slaughter the whole family by the end.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So when we open here, it is Main Street, small town America. I'm not seeing corpses. I'm not seeing death. It almost looks charming. It's only until we cut to this large wall full of posters of missing people. And if you've seen me, call, blah, blah, blah. And then we go into this little market and everything's cleared out with the potato chips. Nobody's going to be crunching on no potato chips in this future.
I didn't even catch that.
Yeah, somehow there's a lot of medication still left too. I guess it would rattle around in those bottles, but you silence that somehow. You take that medication with you. You don't do a trip into town every time you need some pills.
No, but what gets me is all those missing signs. If a meteor crashes and there's all those headlines about what's going on, you know where the missing are. You don't think that they're actually going to show up.
Yeah, you know, you hope is what you do, but you know in your heart that the chances are that, yes, the reason why there are no bodies is that we are food for some creature that finds us because we make noise. And we're noticing that a family is alive in this little grocery store, tiptoeing around, doing their best to treat what looks like the elder boy's stomach ache. I don't know, maybe he ate something bad. That would be my guess. In this future, I'd probably end up getting food poisoning, eating something well past its shelf life, and then needing to go to the pharmacy.
The thing that gets me here is you've said tiptoeing. They're not wearing shoes. I mean, I think there's more danger in not wearing shoes, that you could step on broken glass or rocks or nails, than wearing some sneakers.
Yeah, but I think you could also feel what's underneath your foot. So if you're about to step on a twig, you could feel that.
Yeah, you got a good point.
And they've obviously prepared for this. By day 89, they have a sand trail that leads them to town. So they have already felt out what the path is. And yes, it's pretty obvious the reason why this family has made it while so many haven't. When we cut to Regan, the close-up shot of her, she's wearing a hearing aid. And that means she hasn't fully lost her capacity to hear, but it means that the entire family knows how to do American Sign Language. And that's probably what kept them alive, right? The reason why they didn't perish was that they could communicate and stay close silently.
I do want to adjust one thing, though. That's not a hearing aid. That's specifically a cochlear implant, which is surgically attached for someone who has no hearing. And there's actually some controversy around this because...
No hearing?
Yeah.
Why would you wear something...
Because it's drilled in. It's an implant.
Yeah, that's why she puts it on the back of her head.
But why would you try if you can't hear?
To make you hear... By going past the ear and into the skull.
Okay. Well, then it is a hearing aid. I mean, we're talking semantics here.
But what I'm saying is she has no hearing at all.
Okay. She has hearing as long as this device works, is what she has.
I don't think she does. I think she could, you'll hear like heartbeats, so maybe like low bassy frequencies she could pick up.
I thought she was hearing her own.
A lot of time is being developed to making sure that she regains her hearing, so she must have some at some point, and it's fading, and because we don't have modern technology, it's all for the dad to figure out how to solder something that works.
Usually cochlear implants are because of birth death.
Okay.
And so not fading, just never had the ability to hear.
You keep saying that, but she does have the ability to hear because she has the cochlear implant. Otherwise, why would you put someone through that surgery if they can't hear?
Because you don't know if it'll be successful when you do it.
But she must have had that sound for the dad to be having a drawer full of little receptors.
I think he's hoping.
I think he's been just working on that for 89 days.
89 days, yes. But she is 12 or 13 years old. At some point, she could hear more than nothing.
I don't think so.
I don't agree, and I don't know why you're stuck on that point.
Because what you say makes no sense. She had a device to have her have some kind of understanding of sound, and they are still trying to make that device work in the post-apocalyptic. Thus, it was working for her at one point.
No.
Then why mess with it?
Because you do the implant, and you cross your fingers, and the doctors say there's not a 100% chance they'll hear something.
Yeah?
And it didn't work for her.
Then why are they making the repairs to it?
He's trying to make it work.
He's not repairing. He's trying to build better ones that will allow her to hear.
Huh. Okay. I'll have to rethink on all of that. Because that was... Okay. Yeah. You guys were talking crazy. She never could hear, but he had the belief that one day she could if someone invented... An attachment?
A better implant. They have implants. I work with somebody who has one of these and has had one since he was born. His parents made the choice to have the implant put in, and he does get upgrades to it. As technology evolves, he can now understand words, whereas initially he could only hear sounds. They've gotten better with the implants. So they do a surgery to put the implant in, but then you still have a device on the side of your head that's basically a microphone that's going to filter the vibrations in.
Look, I largely get what you guys have been saying. It was just crazy to me that they would spend any time working on a device if it never worked. But you're telling me that they put the plant thing in and then we'll just keep testing it with new attachments.
That's what the movie tells me.
I mean, to jump to the end, I think that's the big reveal for Reagan when she realizes her dad loved her is because she sees that he's always been working on this device so she could hear.
That helps me understand that moment so much more. Okay, I like this so much more having you shared that medical knowledge. All right, moving on. Thank you. That is exactly the truth then. She cannot hear.
And I get why, okay, it's a quiet place. You got to be quiet, deafness, like it all fits into that sign language. I got to say though, like in real life, would you, like, I don't want to offend our deaf listeners, but like a deaf person doesn't know the noises they're making. If you got to be in a really quiet, like, I wonder what training they did with Reagan, like, don't be so lead-footed. Because if you're deaf, you can't hear the noises you make. You don't know if you're making loud noises or not.
Right. And I think that's part of the tension about the father bringing her along that we see is that he realizes what a risk she is when, all right, so they're heading out, but before they go, Bo has found this toy. She believes in his childhood imagination. This is an easy problem to solve. We'll just find a rocket, go out into space, and then we won't have any more aliens trying to hunt us anymore. And so he is latched onto this and even insisted on taking the space shuttle along with him with batteries that could make this thing a weapon that could kill them all.
I didn't know the first time I saw this exactly what would happen, anything that would happen. So when I see Reagan give him, you know, the parents say, don't take the toy. But Reagan sees that her little brother really wants the toy. She gives him the toy, but the kid on his own sneaks the batteries and gets them in. You know, she gave him a silent piece of plastic.
Yeah.
But basically, you could look at this as the equation of she gave him an unloaded gun, but he grabbed the bullets and loaded the gun because that's what causes his death.
And then the parents just let the youngest one walk behind him. Like, this is my biggest problem with the film. You got a parent in the front and a parent in the back, kids in between. You don't have the youngest kid just, like, walking behind you doing who knows what.
And Emily Blunt, Evelyn's mother, is going to carry that guilt throughout the movie.
Yes, she will.
That is exactly why she is so tortured. Everyone kind of blames himself for what's about to happen.
To me, I thought it was kind of funny. You know, they were walking tallest to smallest. And, you know, that's how you see birds do it, right? I mean, I think of the opening of the Partridge Family, but I also think of actually seeing families of ducks where the tallest walks ahead. But yeah, I was thinking the same thing, that the smallest one is the one who's going to get tired first and lag behind. So watching this the second time, I am like, you know, you're carrying one son, but the other son is just way back there. Nobody even notices he had the space shuttle, or do they just think he never got the batteries?
They don't notice it. And you know what? On day 89, you're not as vigilant as you were on day 3. Like, you get tired, you slip up, you get things fall into a routine, and you assume things, the day is going to go as it always goes. The focus was on Marcus, because he was the one that was ill, and he didn't know, you know, one fart, and they're fucked, right? Like, they got to treat this silently. That was where I think the parents' attention was rightfully put, and unfortunately, by taking their eyes off just for a minute, I mean, it can happen to anyone. I mean, and you will. You live with guilt for the rest of your life because of that 1 millisecond. You weren't paying attention to something that anyone would tell you could easily have happened.
And the reason I was so stunned by this opening, though, is, all right, you're setting up the rules. Sound is dangerous. So I would expect us to see a sound and the repercussions in a way that was like, ooh, that was close. I didn't expect to be introduced to sound and the repercussions by, oh, the baby just died.
Yeah, this almost seems like what you do at the end of the first act, to like, okay, now here's the family's conflict, but no, they're going to get right to it, right off the bat.
And again, that was the screenwriter's choice, to withhold. We would just see this family that was sad and not making noise, and we wouldn't understand why there was all this guilt going on until, yeah, the kickoff of Act 2, when we have this flashback. So, wisely or not, Krasinski realized that it was such a great hook, it would hold the audience for what's going to be a rather sedate next 40, 30 minutes. But yeah, it's a killer, literally and figuratively, to watch this child thinking that, hey, he's in the clear, nobody's around, he's, what, couldn't be more than 4. He just doesn't have the cognitive ability to realize the threat. And so I'm going to pop those batteries in now and wave that rocket around and imagine myself flying up to the sky.
You know, the other thing with children, or at least myself, is you have this belief, you might get in trouble, but you're not going to get killed.
He must know about the aliens, because I've seen the trailer for the new movie, and he's in the baby car seat on day 1. So he knows very well, he has not been shielded from the idea that there's these giant tarantula things running around, but has, for whatever reason, not been traumatized by it the way that Marcus has, and the way that Reagan has.
And we don't get a good glimpse of the alien here. We see, you know, pointy legs and a flash of something, but they're going to kind of tease out before we get really good looks at this.
Yeah, this has got to be a money issue, right? Like, this doesn't have a huge budget.
Nope, wrong. Always part of the design.
Oh, okay.
They said, we're making Jaws. I want to see a fin going through the water. I do not want to see the mechanical shark. And it's also worth pointing out that Krasinski's first design for this alien was scrapped. They filmed things with an entirely different look, and they were not happy about it. And they're not even showing you on bonus features what that look was. So it was probably pretty bad. The note went from the studio was, you need to make them a whole lot more gross. And for whatever reason, they felt like the creature wasn't gross enough. And so We'll talk about the way that it looks, but the idea was always that it was building towards something. This is in the grand tradition of Jaws, or I think even more closely, Signs, M. Night Shyamalan. You know, we're going to see things in the corn, but we're nearly not going to know the aliens until the climax. So we jump, it's over a year later, day 472, October 2nd, 2021.
And Evelyn is pregnant, and, you know, just this is what we do on Now Playing. Is that really an ethical choice to make or a smart choice to make?
I mean, is it a choice?
Yeah, the way I read it, this is a grieving coping mechanism. Like, can we replace this child? Like, because why else would you do that? There is no logical reason to get pregnant in this kind of situation.
Guys, like, you put it in and oops, right? Like, the condom broke.
I don't know. I think you'd be a little bit more careful in this kind of situation.
I think you do whatever you can to ease the stress. And I mean, they obviously are planning for it now, but they seem to be behind. They say if they're just now getting the nursery done, I don't think that she knew about it for a while because, yeah, they only have a couple weeks before something crying and very loud is going to be in their presence. And they have to go underground and put up all of this papier-mâché newsprint and try and hope that that's soundproofing enough to protect the newborn.
But I take this like Jacob did, that this is a coping mechanism. You see this. I know a couple of people who have lost children. And a little time passes, and then they're like, let's have another child. Let's see if that will, you know, I don't know how they think about it, if it's filling a hole in their hearts or replacing something they've lost. But I always took this as this was an intentional pregnancy. And because sound is death, and because imagine a baby in the theater with you during A Quiet Place. It would not be a quiet place. It would be a shrieking place full of noise, because that's what babies are. And even if you accidentally got pregnant, man, I'd be reading books about out-home abortion to save the life of the rest of you.
Yeah, again, you have to take the assumption that it was planned, which I don't. I mean, this story is ultimately about, yes, replacing that child and moving on, because when couples lose kids, sometimes, many times, it can break them up.
Oh, I know couples that have not moved on, and I'll just say it's sad where they're at.
Yeah, I mean, psychologically, they get stuck, or maybe they literally break up. And will this family survive is a question. Obviously, with two kids already, they have their hands full trying to, you know, keep this family intact. It's something they tease, too. It's worth pointing out. First person we see is Reagan. And, you know, I feel like this movie might be stronger if it was told entirely from her vantage point. I feel like I would have liked a movie. Maybe it would have been too hard to do, where we really just focus on the world as she sees it. And Mom comes by holding a basket. She's got a basket of fruit, so you do not see the baby bump for a little bit of time. It's more about how she's feeling guilty. This teenager, she gave her brother that gun with no bullets, and now he's dead, and she believes that her father hates her for that reason. He certainly is keeping her at arm's length.
Yeah, and is he keeping her at arm's length? I kind of get that, but we're supposed to think at the end that he wasn't really doing that, that what he was doing was trying to protect her, because without being able to hear, she's the most at risk of all of them if they leave the compound and things.
The one thing that seems vindictive with the father is at one point, Reagan wants to go down to that basement that has all the radio gear, has those hearing aids, and like, he stops her. You're not allowed to go down there. He seems kind of stern. We never know why that was a forbidden place for her to go. I think little things like that would have helped explain why she might have felt she was unloved.
The way that it comes across is he feels like there's too much opportunity for her to make a noise that she wouldn't be aware of, that she could turn on a knob or something and not know that it was broadcasting a loud sound and putting them all in jeopardy. But you guys bring up an interesting point, and what I feel like is kind of a flaw with these characters. They're very one-dimensional. They're sad people that are upset about what happened at the beginning, and there's no act two for them to have changing relationships. This is a movie that goes from act one to act three, and it would be something if Krasinski's character actually were mad. Like, wouldn't this be a better movie if he had to work through his feelings about what his daughter did, as opposed to finding out, oh, he was never mad at her at all? I mean, that to me feels pat and easy and not dramatically interesting.
And I think that's the result of Krasinski writing, directing, and playing this role. If he were not the actor in this role, maybe he would have thought going darker. But because, like you said, he just had his second daughter, this is about him as a father, he probably can't imagine what it would be like to hate his own daughter or hold a grudge against his own daughter. So here we see him as protector, you know, going back to very sexist stereotypes, but he is the hunter and protector, whereas Evelyn is the nurturer and she's the doctor.
I wish he were scarier. I think the choice could have been made. It seems like Marcus is scared of him. Am I wrong? I pick up that Marcus is scared of everything. Maybe it's just that he's fearful. But we see him here, and he's playing in this dirty pickup truck, and all of a sudden he sees his dad in the rearview mirror, and he's like, oh, gotta get out of here. And, like, again, if I got the sense that the father was mad at his children, or maybe just depressed and starting to act imbalanced, you could portray this family unit as something less wholesome than it is, and it might make these relationships more intriguing.
Well, later on, Evelyn's going to say, who are we if we can't protect them, meaning their children? Here's the problem. Like, the gimmick of this film is they can't talk, they can't make noise. Yet, I feel like there's character development points where they need to have some kind of conversation, like, where they talk about how they feel like they're awful parents because they didn't protect their children, or why, like, how do they feel about bringing this child into this environment and what they're going to go through. Like, I wish there were some more character moments like that.
They'll work those in. They find ways to talk. This is not a dialogue-free movie. There's a waterfall or two.
Yeah, but it's hard for them to have deep, long conversations.
And again, that's the gimmick of this, is that we're trying to tell a dramatic story without that. Even the sign language is kept relatively minimal. If you're illiterate, you probably could still understand most of what was going on.
What I understood was they weren't going to subtitle the sign language for much of the production of this movie.
That could have worked and would have been a brave choice, but probably commercially that was probably not a good idea.
I think if you are going to get rid of that sound, you got to up your visual game. And again, I don't have big complaints with this film. It's mostly little details. Like, we talked about this farmhouse and they're building this underground nursery for the baby and soundproofing. I get confused of just what the setup is, because there's a house, there's a farm, there's basements, but then there's this other underground thing they're building for the baby. It looks like they're still sleeping in their rooms when we see Reagan in her room at one point. Like, I'd figure, yeah, we're all going to sleep underground in a soundproof room. Well, because for me, I know I snore. Like, I need some kind of soundproof and if I'm going to live through the night. Just little visual things like that. If I could have got this layout a little bit better, so I'm not wondering why are they over here versus over here? Oh, that basement is in a different building. Okay. Things like that, that they could have improved or tightened up just a little bit.
Those are all directing choices. But in the original screenplay, a lot more time was given to that kind of consideration. One of the big complaints I think I hear about this movie all the time is, why do they have electricity? Like, why are there lights if we are now well into a year of probably having no burning coal? And, you know, we've seen all the power lines falling down and all of that. The screenwriter specifically wrote in there that there is an underground generator and that was going to be the nursery. And you had that all established. And I think Krasinski's attitude was, let's tell less. Let's have things hinted at, but not explain everything away. You know, just a couple newspaper headlines. We don't need to see the generator that's running the power. Just trust me that they have one somewhere.
Yeah, and I actually agree with that, but when you're talking about story points, I want to understand the layout of what's going on, because you're not going to be saying words saying, hey, that's in the basement in the other house, not in the barn that we're in. So as far as where electricity comes from, I'm not wondering that. I don't care. It's been over a year. So they figured that out somehow. But when it comes to plot points where I need to understand where a character is, tighten that up.
And here's another thing. Like, they would give you the impression here, except for one scene, that they are completely isolated. That they are out here trying to make it all on their own, and it's just the four of them, and that's all they got. Except that Lee, John Krasinski's character, at one point goes to the top of a silo, decides this is the time he's going to burn all of the memorabilia of Bo, and that's going to be a signal to other farms in the distance that will, in synchronicity, also light fires to let them. This is the new internet. This is how you communicate to people. Let them know you're still alive. Those farms seem close enough that you could go there, right? Like, you would want to try and still make contact if you believed you had farmer neighbors.
They're also going to just run across a crazy guy with his dead wife in the woods, too. So there's people around, but they don't really explain them very well at all.
They don't have to explain why they're there. They have to explain why they're not collaborating and everyone coming together and helping run one farm instead of living in isolation. That, to me, is a bizarre choice. If I knew somebody was 5 miles away, I can walk quietly to that farm and try and set up some kind of connection better than... They're not even doing Morse code. Like, he is going to the basement to cross off radio frequencies. He's determined to try and radio people, but the people that are in his own backyard, he has nothing to say to. It's strange. But how does this make you feel? I've got to say, at this point, we're about 20 minutes into the movie, and the lack of dialogue and sound is kind of getting to me. Like, I am feeling strangely unnerved by the fact that there hasn't been conversation and that they can't break up these moments.
And even to the point, the silence, look, I didn't do a chart and graph this out, but the feeling I got as I was watching this, what I was noticing was, like, there wasn't even score playing during the silent parts, or at least most of them. Usually score came in when they could talk to kind of sell those moments. But yeah, when they're going silent, they're going, yeah, just ambient noise. And yeah, it really does set a mood and a vibe. Like the fact that, oh, they're smoking their food. Okay, yeah, you don't want a crackling fire and sizzling and all that. Okay, like it does really sell the situation they're in, at least for me.
That's where I'm at too, is on paper, you'd think a movie with no sound could cease to engage. Because when you watch a movie, you have really two senses going, sight and sound. And if you take away one of those, there's a reason a lot of people don't like going back and watching old silent movies. It's because there's no audio. Would you be disengaged? I'm happy to say that when I watched this at home, I was wondering. I knew the theatrical experience was incredible because I was just immersed. And every sound was so important. And you wonder at what decibel level, you know, will the monsters attack? I had the same experience rewatching it at home. I was afraid, you know, I used the home theater, but I was afraid that just in the home environment, it wouldn't sell as well. And admittedly, at one point, I thought there was a sound in the movie. I'm like, is that a siren? No, my Frenchie had fallen asleep.
Yeah, there's no way that a pug's going to make it in this future. She snorted the whole time. I'm just like, could you be quiet? Please?
Yeah, pugs and Frenchies will be the first to go.
Yeah, they can chew them up real quick. But, you know, I was just thinking about how it helps to put this audience in this unease, to get into that feeling that silence is repression. Because I'm feeling that. I'm feeling like I can't bear this. What is the point of living? I mean, that's the existential question. When they're sitting down and having this meal with, like, leaves as plates in all of this, and you're thinking about why they've made these choices, they're almost erasing their own existence. It's like they're so quiet. Can God hear them when they're trying to pray? I mean, how do you tell yourself it's worth going on if this is life on day 472?
See, this is what I was getting at when I asked if it was ethical to have a baby. You guys kind of shooed me away on that conversation, but the fact is propagation of the species the goal? Is it that we need to procreate and have more humans? Is that the biological imperative of the survivors is procreation? Or is the biological imperative survival of those who were there and realizing that procreating is a weakness?
Either way, the humans are going to disappear. If you stay silent and don't procreate, you're going to die off. And if you procreate, you're going to have babies. That's going to cause issues. You might die off that way, too. But either way, it's grim.
I mean, I think that's why we're going to see that old man make that choice later. It's like you would really go crazy. Even Dostoevsky talked when he was in the gulags. Like, prisoners had to make noise. When they were chained up in isolation, they would just scream to reassure themselves they were alive. Because if you can't hear yourself, you know, a tree falls in the woods kind of question here. Like, at what point do I feel that I even exist if I can't make a sound and impact this world? Yeah, it's incredibly depressing. It's incredibly heavy, much more so than you would expect in a popcorn PG-13 sci-fi horror flick. I mean, this feels, I think Signs tried to play with this issue with the family dealing with the dead mom, but this is just doing it so much better, using aliens as a metaphor for grief and depression. And they're obviously trying to just create a normal space for their kids. They're obviously, they've sewn together a quiet version of Monopoly.
I do love that detail. They're using like felt pieces so they don't make noise as you clack it on the board.
You know what? I like Monopoly a lot.
You do? No one likes Monopoly. No one's finished a game on Monopoly ever.
Like, but you want to be able to say in your face. Like, I can't imagine rolling and then being quiet as you win. You know that Regan really wants to. She's winning the game, and the kid gets mad and he's swinging his arms, and before you know it, yeah, there's a blanket fire because he knocked over the lantern.
And the fire's the second of the dangers, the first being the sound of the lantern.
Yeah, exactly. And again, should this have been an action scene? It's been so sedate, quiet. I mean, they advertise that's what you're coming for, a quiet place. But I feel like it has been a long time now, almost 25 minutes without an action scene. And it just ends up being raccoons.
I feel bad for those raccoons because I guess aliens don't like raccoon meat. They just smash that thing. Like there's nothing to eat afterwards.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that I would. It would be my first choice to dine on. But yeah, you would think at this point they'd be getting a little hungry. We've seen some birds in the air. We know that there's some wildlife here. But again, if the animals are dying off, how long before the whole forest collapses? I mean, there's a whole interdependence on the ecosystem to these creatures that make noise.
How did the creatures, if they need to eat to survive, survive the trip of years and years in space on a comet?
Well, no, you're assuming that they need to eat every 12 hours. I mean, maybe they go into hibernation. Maybe they can, you know, shut down for long periods of time, ride that meteorite, and then when they get there, break out the bib and go to town.
You know, there's a lot of logistics around this movie. Like, how did aliens get on a meteorite?
They're like Venoms. Venoms rode on a meteor.
Yeah, I think of the alien. I mean, honestly, I think a lot about the xenomorph from the alien, because when we see them, it's in my face. But yeah, the idea that they're the ultimate survivor. They can work with minimal means. They can go for long periods of time. They don't need to see. They have this hard shell. They will protect themselves. And when the time is right, they will dine and they will nourish. And so maybe it will just take a long time. It's not very clear how many aliens there are in the world. I think we see in the notes that Lee has put up, there have been 6 crash sites, and he has seen 3 aliens in his farmland area. And that's all that we really know about how many of these, I don't know what we want to call them, these sound creatures are here.
Yeah, when he listed that there were 3, coming back, I paid attention to that. I thought, you know, that would be a countdown. Kill 3 and survive, you know? But no, that's not where this movie's going to go. And you ask, do we need an attack here? Is raccoons enough? The thing is, to me, this is a suspense film. And the fact that it is so silent, there's only one scene, I think, that really breaks suspense. And so it's like a taut wire that is just right there. I never get bored. I'm constantly anxious because I saw what happened to little Bo, and if it happens again, I just assume every sound means somebody here is going to be plucked off.
Okay, so it is just the level of tension is so high for you that even though we go half an hour, 40 minutes before we're really getting into the kinds of things a horror movie audience would want, you can go with the mood.
Oh, absolutely.
I agree. I like the survival aspect. Again, all those things that you see them doing and trying to stay quiet. What happens when they do make a sound, knock over the lantern. Like, just as a survival movie, I find it interesting because of this gimmick that you can't make noise. So I'm taken in just by that.
Oh, okay. I'll be, I guess, a little bit more of a naysayer. I like it. There are nice moments. Like when Evelyn goes to see Lee in the basement and they have their dance to the Neil Young sharing an earbud. I thought that was really sweet and tender. But I'd be lying if I said I didn't want something to happen, because it's hard to sit in misery. It's hard to sit with people that are miserable and not have any sense of release or dramatic idea that they could change their circumstance. I don't know what we're supposed to be hoping for them to do. They obviously haven't built a rocket to take Bo's idea to fly to space. So all they've banked everything on is a room in their barn that has some newsprint on it. And that's all that they got. And an oxygen tank for helping the baby breathe when they put it in a crate. I mean, I guess I would like to see them working on a more dramatic project.
He's an engineer. Couldn't he build actual soundproof rooms? I mean, they exist.
But without tools? I mean, again, you can't use drills, you can't use hammers, you gotta do it quietly.
That's true, and I thought about it, because when he goes downstairs, Those are some rickety-ass wooden stairs. How do you get those to not creak? I mean, you can make stairs that don't creak. You need a tool, at least a hammer, to do it.
Well, I think that's why they painted certain floorboards. Those are the ones you're supposed to step on because they won't make the noise.
Right. It's very clear that the sequel has Krasinski in it and that they start on day one. And we may actually see more of how they got to where they were. But for this movie, I don't think it's really necessary. But we accept on face value that everything is about preparing for a child that nobody is sure will live very long.
And of course, they have Chekhov's nail here. We see her carrying some laundry up the stairs in this burlap sack. It gets stuck on a nail. We know where this is going to go eventually. It's just set up right here that somebody's going to step on a nail.
Right. Most of the action happens October 3rd, 2021, 20 days before she's due. So she's had to do all her medical care herself. We see that she's writing down her blood pressure, listening to the baby and all that. I mean, she obviously could get it wrong. It makes you appreciate modern medicine's ability to schedule a birth at an exact day and time here. The fact that she's like, yeah, I think it's going to be 3 weeks. Oh, wait, my water's breaking. I mean, like, that's, it's a ticking clock that it's delicious in terms of its suspense. We just, how is she going to deliver a baby quietly?
Yeah, I mean, women scream while giving birth unless they're put under and...
Or Scientologists. You know, that's a whole thing, the silent birth.
I need to see a video of it to believe that. But
yeah. But meanwhile, the day is proceeding as normal. Like you said, chores. Everyone's got things to do. And Lee wants to insist that scaredy cat Marcus get out there and help him fish.
Why today of all days?
Yeah, I mean, again, I feel like the most underdeveloped character is Marcus. We don't understand much about him. He came into this story sick. And now he is, I mean, I understand being afraid and, you know, even, you know, agoraphobic and not wanting to leave the farm. But I feel like I don't understand his relationship with his parents. His mom is still teaching him math. And my sense is that he wants to be close to her. And not unlike Reagan, he's a little afraid of Dad, which, again, I wish Dad looked more like the Unabomber. I wish maybe if we saw him going down into that basement, we believe that he was making a bomb or a weapon instead of, you know, things for the cochlear device.
I mean, I will give this film credit, being someone who did watch all of The Office. I don't think of Jim Halpert during this movie. Maybe it's because Krasinski grew that big old bushy beard. Maybe it's not quite Unabomber, but I will say I think he did a pretty good job for being someone that is known for one role primarily to put that out of your mind. And yeah, when he has to come off as stern, again, I'm thinking Jim Halpert, would he ever be a stern dad? I don't know. But this one, I just wish they gave me reasons. I get the tension between the family members. I'm just not 100% sure why.
I mean, it couldn't be enough to be like, I'm kind of going crazy.
Yeah, give us a scene of that.
Like, it's been a year of this. I think I would much prefer, they tell us too early that he's working on the cochlear device. Mm-hmm. He should be doing something that looks dangerous. He should be trying to make a weapon or just something that makes him seem like, oh, maybe he's going to kill his whole family. Like, if the children's impression is that Dad scares me and I don't want to be around him or he doesn't love me, I think you just got to have someone that isn't as so affable and loving as this Lee.
And I think he does a decent enough job of playing a survivalist father in pain. But yes, I never get scary off of him.
Mm-hmm. It would have been an interesting choice to do. And in a horror movie, it seems like the right choice. But this is Krasinski. All of his earlier directing efforts were dramas. And I think that that's what he brought to this script. He threw out a lot of their horror movie ideas so that he could work in his issues with being a parent. And so it's a nice moment when he actually gets his son out there and shows him that the sound of the river allows them to have a conversation like a normal father and son. It almost feels like a dad fishing trip.
It just makes me think, though, why aren't there more humans living along the river?
Yeah, this is the point where the movie's logic breaks for me. Okay, if there are loud sounds, constant sounds, then the aliens can't hear you and they go away. So the aliens just realize this is like white noise. Okay, live by the water. Or if you have electricity, Blare fucking rock music all the time at 11 around your house. Get those speakers going, and eventually you can make all the sound you want inside your house, because they're not going to be able to get past the concert that's going on.
I mean, I think you're right, but the fact of the matter is you turn on that stereo and they're going to break down the door and kill you right then. It's not going to be years of that noise.
Yeah, you do got to leave for like a week until they realize that there's nothing there. I agree.
Did they all just attack a waterfall for a while?
Yes, that's what I'm imagining. That they really had lots of fun at, like, yeah, just natural sounds and noises. And yeah, it would be an interesting movie if we followed their perspective. I don't know.
But why not live at the waterfall? I mean, seriously, if there is a kryptonite to these, or at least an invisibility cloak around these creatures, I would think there'd be communities living under a waterfall.
Okay, I want to see you lie on that rock for a year. I want to see when you know that there's a bed somewhere that you could be on. I mean, it's hard to give up your bed, would be my answer to that.
I could sleep on a rock if it meant survival.
They're making it work. They are surviving. He has engineered all of these things that allow them to have the best of the modern world while still staying quiet.
Where's the best place to give birth to a crying baby? In a newspaper room or by the river?
Well, that's true. Yeah, she could definitely plan to go there. And that is probably a flaw.
Well, that might have been the plan. She goes into labor like 2 weeks, 3 weeks early.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I also think the fact that they aren't done with that room, that they're still papering and doing all of that, implies to me that they didn't realize until 4 or 5 months into her pregnancy, oh my God. Again, I'm not letting go of the idea that it was unplanned.
She's a doctor. By the second missed period, she should know.
Maybe. I mean, it's a weird time, right? She's a doctor? Where do you get that?
From all the blood pressure tests and all the medical stuff she's doing, I thought she was a doctor in the real world.
Oh, I just assumed she grabbed that from an Aldi's or something like that. I had no impression that they were anything other than farmers.
He's doing a lot of electricity work, and she's doing a lot of medical stuff and listening to the heartbeat with the stethoscope and knowing exactly where to listen. I took it that she was some kind of medical person.
I thought they were just farmers that knew how to sign language, and that gave them an edge over farmers that didn't. And they've had time enough now to learn traits that they didn't have before.
Yeah, farmers, they got to fix their John Deere tractors, so it's not out of this world that he's mechanical and could mess around with stuff.
Right. And so, all right, so the son is somewhat comforted to know that he can speak his mind and tells his dad, you need to tell Reagan that you love her. I mean, I don't know why he doesn't know that. I mean, he knows she tried to come along with them and he blew her off. So he should know that he's doing this and kind of own that. He says, I don't blame her. It's nobody's fault. But I think he actually does. And I could understand why he would.
Yeah, why doesn't he tell her that? Like, when they're going off to this waterfall and Reagan wants to go, like, why doesn't he just say, oh, no, I'm going to take you another time. This is for Marcus today.
Because I think he's not going to take her because she can't hear.
Right. The reason is that he does holding it against her, but they dramatically don't deal with that.
Or is it that she, because she can't hear, would be a danger to herself and others out in the wilderness?
Yeah, it's a large part of that. Yeah, he has not forgiven her for that rocket.
They don't set that up, though, that she doesn't know she's making sounds when she's walking around in the world. And this is only a 90-minute film. They could add a couple minutes here and there to flesh things out.
Well, here's what they have. Every time they cut on a close-up of her, we get her audio perspective. And as you say, they take out all room noise, all audio track, and it is just a void. And if you remember, she didn't hear the rocket going off behind her. All she saw was her parents turning around in horror when Bo turned on his toy. And so that was if she had heard it, maybe she could have gotten to him first. I'm not going to spend any more time on this. This movie is telling us these are people that are guilt-ridden. And in the middle of this movie, we have Reagan going off. She has made, I think, this shrine and has clipped the sound on this shuttle so that it can blink its lights like he enjoyed and be on his gravesite. And Mom, meanwhile, yeah, before she goes into labor, she's up in that one room nobody goes into, looking at the mobile, thinking about Bo.
And really, once you get to the river and they can talk and there's sound, that breaks the tension for me. It gives me a breather of sorts because I'm no longer in suspense because they're in a safe place, you know? And even though we're going to cut to Reagan. But Reagan seems like she's in a pretty safe place. She's going to fall asleep there on the bridge.
I was wondering, was she running away for good? She packs a bag, and I know she doesn't feel welcome there. My sense was that she was not going to go back home, but just stopped at the graveside on the way to wherever and came back because of the fireworks.
I thought she was just going for a day trip.
Yeah, I thought she's just going to the gravesite because she obviously feels guilt for that, for giving her brother the rocket back.
You pointed out there's a shrine there that she probably built and she clipped the wires. I think she does this regularly.
It could be, but I also felt like later in the movie, she's going to make the case that Dad isn't coming for her and she just wants to go. So again, these things remain nebulous because they don't have the capacity to speak the words that would clarify. And that's not even a criticism. I think that this movie works well because it is one you can debate motive, because there are these unclean lines. Speaking of unclean lines, old man burying his wife. What do you think happened there?
I thought he murdered her.
Yeah, maybe, right? But why scream? I thought he screamed because the love of his life was dead.
I don't know. She looks like she has a stab wound. That's why I went to murder. And maybe he just felt guilt. I don't know.
Maybe she killed herself by stab, which is not the way I would want to kill myself. But hey, to each their own.
Mercy murder / suicide to get them out of a situation that was unlivable.
But wasn't he burying her?
You still bury those you love.
Well, why does he scream then? He doesn't have her buried when he screams.
You know what? I like the effect of the scene, even though some logic problems are here with us. And the fact that they're just passing by at the exact moment that all of this is happening is a whole lot of convenience.
But you really do need a moment like this at this point in the film. Like, you need some kind of scare.
I feel like it should go even longer. I feel like once the alien swoops in, decapitates this guy, why can't we have a scene of him like, well, here's the thing I wonder. I get that they hear, and maybe they can't see. Can't they smell?
I don't think so. I think it's just their head is just a big old ear and a mouth.
They make this predator click thing. I'm wondering if there's like some echolocation kind of stuff going on. Like,
you know, this is more than just hearing. There is some electrical impulse, because we'll see when they get close to electricity, lights flashed. I think that's why the hearing aid works so well against them.
The radio as well seems to not work on their approach. And yes, her hearing aid, her cochlear implant is feeding back. All mechanical things go kaflooey. I think that's the scientific term for it, when these creatures come by. And why that is another part of their mystique. But at this point, we're seeing a lot more of them. What do you guys think of the design? At this point, we understand that they look like those things from the Dark Crystal that like walked on those stilt legs.
Yes, I know what you're talking about. I don't, again, to me, it feels like I'm not slamming this because it looks like they don't have a whole lot of money, but these creature designs, I don't know, they look pretty basic to me. You're going to get a cool shot later on when they finally open up that head and you see all the gooey ear parts. Like, that's cool. But when they're just running really fast, I don't know. I don't feel you ever really get a vision of them. And it, again, I chalked it down. You're saying Jaws. I also think maybe it's a little bit of money.
Yeah, you know what? Yes. What you say on a commentary track may not be the full truth. And there might have been some aspiration to at least have a better looking creature. They did call Michael Bay and he sent over some of the Transformer people to try and give a creature design, and that's what they're using.
Oh, well, that explains why it looks the way it looks. They use the Transformer people. No wonder I couldn't tell the aliens apart. But I think it just looks like bad CGI. Subpar for what I'm used to today, even in lower budget films. You tell me that they had to replace the design at the end. This feels like a rush job.
Better than Signs, though. We can all agree they look better than the aliens in Signs.
Oh, yeah. Come on.
Yeah, but that was 20 years ago, and I didn't even like that movie. And here, let me give it the most big insult. I wouldn't buy a toy of it.
Okay.
I mean, I just think it's a bland looking design of, it looks like a brain with legs, you know, that, or a seed pod or something.
To me, it just looks like a cheap version of the alien without the elongated head.
Well, there you go. I was trying to hold onto as long as I could, because obviously when you have a sightless, dark-skinned, armored xenomorph that, you know, either alien or venom. Like, the way that it opens its mouth and those teeth and that tongue, it really does feel like something we've seen before. That is scary. I mean, I know that's why, but it feels like the discount bin knockoff version of this. I guess the point is that when it actually opens up its face to get its best sense of hearing, you get that gooey, cochlear-looking thing, which I think is it's Achilles' heel. If you were to shoot into that, what she does in the end, it is vulnerable at that one spot.
Because it's not armored. The armor plating protects them, but under the armor is fleshiness that can be hurt. But when it opens its plates to listen, it looks, yeah, it does look like an ear canal, but you get this in extreme close-up, so I can't really tell, are we just looking at the side of its head where it has an ear, or are we looking at the whole head? Like so many things in horror, it's so much scarier before you see it.
Yeah, other people have complained about the Demogorgon. I don't watch Stranger Things, but I have seen that creature has a face that parts like a flower, and, you know, maybe this has a Stranger Things vibe. I don't know.
But I like the aliens' attack. I like the aliens' methods. But yes, when it's just a flash of death, it is so much more dangerous than when it's like sniffing around with its ears. Like, did I hear something?
Yeah, I mean, it just feels like an angry dog at that part. And it's coming home because Evelyn has broken that water, trying to get down to the basement, and stepped on that nail. Ow, that really does hurt.
I gotta say, yes, I have done this twice in real life. Oof. Stepped on a nail in my younger years. I can't watch this scene. I always turn away. Like, this is the grossest part of this movie for me, stepping on a nail. It's not the going in that's hurt. It's when you realize you've stepped on a nail and you gotta get it out.
Yeah, I can't imagine puncturing that deep. I've had puncture wounds, but there's, like, not enough tetanus shots in the world that, like, I feel like I would be dead. I don't know how she does it. I don't think you could. If you actually stepped on this, I don't think you could be quiet. I know that she's got a lot of grit and determination, but sorry, the word ow would come out of my mouth.
I think the word fuck would come out of mine, but she does make sound. She makes a oof. Yeah. She's conscious enough to not scream.
But she's also having contractions.
Yes.
I mean, like, it's on top of all of this. She has the wise idea of, I'll set the egg timer. I'm going to scrounge around. They have, like, a box of things that makes noise that they put away. She finds that egg timer, gets it going, which has the unfortunate byproduct of inviting the creature down the steps to hear the ticking. But once it goes off, allows her to at least run upstairs to where she thinks she can get away. But then there's another one on the lawn. The second creature seems to come and go, right? Like, the fact she can't run out to the arriving men because there's one on the lawn and one downstairs.
I think the one on the lawn then goes to the grain bin with the fireworks.
Nuh-uh. That's one that's chasing her to the nursery, and the only reason why it doesn't eat her in the waterlogged nursery is because of the grain bin.
That's what I'm saying. This film needs to work on its geography. Like, I want to know where things are and where they're going a little bit better than they portray them.
And it should be said, in the original script, there was five of them. They had a whole lot going on. They had figured out when to kill it a lot earlier, too. So it wasn't like they had to contend with everything in the final seconds of the movie the way it's set up here. Here, they want to make it this magical moment of we found the weakness by having the child finally go down into the basement way at the end.
But we had the moment earlier. She was in the cornfield and one snuck up behind her. She didn't realize what was happening, but her implant started making this feedback noise that hurt her, and she doesn't realize it scared off an alien, but she has this revelatory moment. I finally heard something.
Yeah, that's true. I guess what I'm wondering is, would it be better to get to some killing now, earlier? Would it take away from the sense of hopelessness that hangs over this movie? And is that a bad thing if they find out they can fight back before Act 3 begins?
I don't know. You keep saying hopelessness. I'm taken in by this dilemma. Like, how are you going to give birth now? These monsters walking around, you're going to make sense. Like, again, that survival aspect. How are you going to go about these tasks without alerting these monsters? I don't know if I need Starship Troopers and they're shooting each other and fighting at this point. I'm so taken in just, again, by the drama of this family trying to do, I mean, giving birth on everyday thing, but, you know, it's a normal thing.
It is an everyday thing. I mean,
well, for every, yeah, yeah. If you take the human population, I mean, for a person.
You don't have a birth every day, the same person, but yes, it is a common occurrence that everyone can probably relate to because they were all born.
But for one person, yeah, how are they going to go about doing this task? And so I'm taken in by that stuff. I'm not wanting a big fight. I'm never missing a big fight at this moment.
You know, here's what my equation would be for this. And it's really unfair to this movie, but I hate reality television, okay? I can't stand dating shows on TV. I don't even like those primetime game shows. But yet, I find myself sucked in to, it used to be Who Wants to Be a Millionaire or Dancing with the Stars or these insipid shows.
You should hate reality TV more if you're getting taken in by those.
Well, how do you feel on The Masked Singer? Just curious.
I watched one episode. But you know why I get sucked in? Is impressive production quality and the score, the, you know, in Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Ba-da-da-ba-da-da-boom. The music, the way that they make everything so suspenseful, they leave you on the hook of these reality shows. Now, that is impressive production quality if they could take insipid shit and make it feel like it's the most important thing you're in the world at that moment. And I think that's what this movie's done. I don't need killing in action because I'm so wrapped up. Like Jacob said, how are they going to give birth? I don't know that they should, but let's get past that. They're here. They're going to give birth. How are they keeping a baby quiet? Oh my God, what's she going to do with that nail? Oh, what is going to happen? I'm just so into what's happening with the what if, that I don't need fighting. There's four of them, and I assume every time that there's a fight, that there's going to be a fight, we're going to lose another one.
No, and I'm not necessarily arguing for it. I'm just saying it's a whole lot to wait till the very end to figure out how they're going to kill.
It sounds like you want the Michael Bay version of this.
No, I never want anything Michael Bay. I can assure you of that. I can say that this movie feels, like I said, strangely stagnant in the middle because it doesn't have an act two. Because it goes from, here are some people that are sad, to, and now let's watch them run around. I feel like, dramatically speaking, I wanted something to happen that would change things up in the middle. That's what you want an act two to do. All the rules are thrown out, and now we're headed in a different direction. And I feel like these are still the same people, with their still same mopey problems. And I kind of want them to get on with it in some weird way, even though I'm sympathetic. I mean, I don't want to seem insensitive. I'm with this movie. I like this movie. I just, that's my sense.
I will agree as far as pacing goes. Yes, all the action is in this third act with giving birth to fighting aliens, the grain scene, like all the action scenes fall during the last half hour.
Yes, they do. But I feel that we're getting the character exploration and we're finding out more about them with that trip to the river. We're learning who these characters are and they're learning where each other stand through this.
Now, they're not learning a new thing at all about them. Like, they're the same people in that river that they were at the beginning. Like, that's my problem. Dramatically speaking, yeah, they're still mopey and sad and guilt-ridden.
This feels like it's still day 90 versus day 470-something. It feels like this is what they'd be going through earlier on in this journey.
Yeah, if you think of any movie about being stir-crazy, locked up, I mean, the Donner Party, I mean, like, this family should be trying to kill itself. I mean, like, the only enemy is not just the alien at this point. They'd be turning on each other. And I feel like, dramatically speaking, if Krasinski wasn't so fixated on talking about grief, this movie could deal with that.
Stuart, I will give it this, though, because if you've seen It Comes at Night, that trailer looks super good. I was wondering what comes at night. Apparently, it's just paranoia and people fighting. Like, I feel like a lot of people were disappointed with that movie because you were promised an alien or a monster or something, and it is just people fighting the whole time with themselves.
So is The Walking Dead, really. I mean, you know, there's a reason they call it The Talking Dead. The zombies are not usually in it. It's the people arguing. And you know what? If you want to make A Quiet Place also, you can have those people who turn on each other. But this is about a family who's very tight-knit and coming together and staying together as a unit, although they're having problems, but their number one goal is each other's survival. They have each other's best interest at heart.
Yeah, that's dramatically boring as hell. That is boring. A family that loves each other. Movie I don't need to see. Like, I need to see a family work through a problem.
You've heard it here. Stuart hates families that love each other.
No, I'm saying, dramatically speaking, nobody likes to watch that movie. Nobody wants to see a movie where everyone gets along and loves each other and no one ever feels, I mean, maybe on Hallmark, you know, there is something about like comfort, but I just definitely feel like they need to work through things. They need to show different sides to each other.
And I agree, Stuart, that's the problem with the second act or non-existent second act of this film. When I get into the third act here, I'm all in for this ride. And I don't mind that they're not fighting the aliens right away.
Okay, yeah. And I'm all in too. Believe me, how could I not be with nails going through feet? And yeah, all of this stuff is really good. The suspense, Krasinski, whatever I feel about him as a dramatist, as he could be a new Hitchcock. He could definitely set up some of this stuff in a non-alien thriller. I feel like he could do suspense.
See, the way I see it is Act 1 is the, we're getting to know the circumstance. From the killing of Bo to the time that they go out hunting, we're learning what the daily routine is. We're learning what it's like to live in this post-apocalyptic world. Act 2 is where things change because they fragment. They split apart, and they each have their own little crisis that happens, be it the old people or be it stepping on the foot. To me, Act 3 begins after the birth has happened, because we still have a half an hour of the movie left after the baby's born.
Yeah, you could say that. I guess you can make that case. I just feel like the old man didn't really explore or show anything new about this family. Like, all it did was give Lee the idea that if I am going to kill myself, I'll shout. I can't say it any more plainly than I already have. I don't feel like this family has any problems with each other than they can't tell each other how much they love each other. It would be evident if they weren't so depressed.
And to me, this does have some feelings to it of like some of those religious movies or Hallmark, like you say. But, you know, the family as a unit is not going to be fractured. It's man against nature, not man against man.
Just speaking from screenwriting terms, people that don't have problems in a movie is not a movie you want to watch. I mean, you really want to see people work through their problems in a movie. That's drama. That is what we've come to see. So the fact that they're this monolith and there's no tension between them, it's just...
So are you saying The Revenant isn't any good because it's mostly one person?
The Revenant? With Leonardo DiCaprio?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't like that movie, but that's for lots of reasons.
I mean, I just think that the struggles here are external. It's a survival movie. It's a disaster movie. There's not always have to be rote internal struggles to work through in three acts.
I agree. Again, if this is elevated horror, if they're doing something more than just titillating you with gore and people getting eaten by aliens, you do want some kind of drama. And I do think all the drama here is very surface level. It doesn't go very deep. Oh, my dad hates me. You could have had a 2-minute conversation to sort that out. They don't. She's going to realize it at the end for a more emotionally manipulated dramatic pull. But yeah, it could have been better.
Yeah, I agree. Finn, out of the frying pan into the fire kind of stuff. It really starts with the fact that, yeah, she goes up to the bathtub to give birth. I think the aliens just keep getting distracted. Every time it's about to munch, it hears a louder noise and thinks, oh, that sounds more delicious. It hears the fireworks.
Yeah, I don't think she was making noise. The alien was in the house because of the whole basement thing. It didn't necessarily know she was in the bathtub. But yeah, when Marcus sets off those fireworks, I guess it's going to go to that louder sound. They're not very smart, are they? Because that seems like an obvious distraction.
Yeah, you know, and it's called rockets. I think that's, again, meant to make us think about the rocket that little Bo was suggesting would save their life. And you really realize, again, take all the aliens out of this. And this is about the decision of, can we hold together and make another son after we've lost one? Like, can we have the one that loved the rockets again? There's all of this when she gets saved. In fact, you know, we think she's talking about her newborn baby because she says, I could have held him. And then we realize, oh no, by looking at her newborn child, she's still thinking about the child that was taken from her. She is processing and I suppose getting over feels a little bit trite to say. She's not getting over the loss of her child, but she's at least getting to a better position of being comfortable and self-forgiving.
Dealing with the grief that she has repressed by focusing on the emergency at hand instead of dealing with self-care.
Right. And yes, Krasinski comes barging in with a shotgun, but the alien has already left. The second one that was on the lawn is somewhere. And yeah, they go back to the nursery and that works. The baby is obviously going to cry. And as they're going down into it, we see the creature coming. It breaks the pipes, right? The reason why everything starts flooding with water is because the creature upstairs just starts throwing a fit and breaks water pipes.
That's how I took it.
I can't think of any other reason why all of a sudden, in this soundproofed room, suddenly there's giant water leaks. But it's because they have paper mache wallpaper, and that's a lot of water to be gushing out of the pipes that the alien broke. And this is probably my favorite scene, when Emily Blunt is going to wake up, and there's her little baby floating around like Moses in that little thing. And that thing at the bottom of the stairs just diving into that water. And you're like, oh, shit. She's walking there. How do I get to the baby before it surfaces?
Yeah, I don't remember. I'm sure you know which one, Stuart, but an alien. Don't they come out of the water in one of them? And it's just frightening, like, seeing these creatures come out of the water. And, again, this kind of looks like a xenomorph. So when it's going underneath, swim around. It's a scary moment.
Yeah, Newt gets grabbed in a waterlogged scenario in part two. And I also think about the third one where the creature gets right up in her face and, like, just, how's she going to get out of this?
What about the fourth one where they go swimming underwater with bad CGI?
There's the fourth one. We could talk about it. I don't need to, but yeah, that happened.
Yeah, I thought of the fourth one. I didn't want to bring it up.
But here, for some reason, I know that the mother and baby aren't going to die. I mean, despite killing the little kid early on, at this point in the movie, with about a half hour to go, I feel like I know somebody else is going to die, and it won't be them. Everybody will sacrifice themselves for mother and baby if need be. But I don't think they're going to kill any more kids. I'm pretty sure John Krasinski's going to die at some point. But the mother and child, despite I still love the sound design going on, I'm not feeling the suspense when that thing is sniffing around in the water. I'm just like, they're not going to do it. Something pulled me out of this movie. Once they went to the river, I got out of the movie and couldn't get back in just as well.
So you're actually finding this part, which I would call the goods, to be the less interesting part.
Suspense is a wonderful thing, and then once it's broken with action, how good is that action? And here I'm like, meh.
I don't think I ever believed that the mother or baby would die or the two kids, but I'm still scared for them. I still think they create real tense moments for them to be in. Like when the kids, they're on that grain silo and fall in and they're sinking. Like that is a real thing. Like hundreds of people die that in grain silos, just sinking. And like, that is terrifying. I don't think they're ultimately going to die, but that is a tense moment for me.
It happens in our area at least once a year.
Yeah, in the Midwest, I'm sure it happens a lot.
Yeah, somebody is found in a fucking grain bin, and sometimes there's a full body, sometimes there's just a skeleton, and you wonder how much of that grain we ate.
Well, here's what I would say to that, and it goes back to my earlier point about maybe they should have come up with a weapon by this point. It gets kind of old because you realize every time the creature has cornered them, they hear a sound and it runs away. And that bit to me is like, okay, we need for you a way to fight them or defeat them or at least escape to a new area. It's boring that distraction is the thing that is always saving you at the last minute and one that you didn't even create by yourself.
I think it helps, though, that this is all smashed into the last 20 minutes of the film. Like, I could see if the whole film was every time there was a dangerous situation, they just, like, tossed a rock a couple feet away and the alien ran that way. I guess because it's so compressed here, it just feels all like one action piece.
Yeah, it's very well edited. It should be said, it's kind of hard to talk about this climax because everything is happening, you know, like one shot and then we move on to over here and Krasinski's over there. And yeah, that also creates some confusion about where everyone is standing geographically. But I do think as far as keeping the momentum going and the pace going, yeah, kids are drowning in grain at the same time that Emily Blunt's under the water with the baby. And yeah, it's just easy to get caught up in all that's gone wrong for this family.
Yeah, I do think that the kids, when I watched it this time, I couldn't remember how they got out of that grain bin because, I mean, that's a bad situation. They're drowning in the grain. They're fortunately able to get a piece of metal to cling on to, like the end of Titanic there with grain.
I was thinking Titanic, yeah.
It's pretty hard to believe that Marcus has the upper body strength to pull that sister out from being completely submerged when he himself wasn't standing on anything.
And an alien comes in and attacks and then a noise and it jumps out the side and breaks it open and that's how they're able to get out. We just see them like jumping down from it later on.
Yeah, we're seeing that Reagan is beginning to learn that her earpiece is a weapon. And, you know, as Arnie already pointed out, we had an earlier scene of her alone. And I don't think she ever turned around to know that what caused that feedback was an alien. But the alien, now I'm getting it. You guys help me. she's hearing for the very first time when that alien approaches.
Mm-hmm.
So it's giving her a gift at the same time it's putting her life into peril. And she's realizing in this grain silo, it's a little bit different now because she can connect the fact that it couldn't take it as she was hearing sound.
And she's realizing that it's also a warning system for her. She now knows when she hears that sound that there's something around, which she had no way of knowing before.
Right. And so now she really does have great knowledge. She could, if only she can get to Dad, they can use this, weaponize this. Dad, you never invented me a great earpiece, but you sure got a great solution to these bugs. Let's do this. I don't know. It's a little contrived how they take Lee out of this, right? We've got to admit, like, there's no reason for him to stand around by a shed and be swiped at by an alien.
No, it's convenient that, you know, they have him get wounded. The kid screams, Dad, you know, instinctive, like the mother probably would have with a nail in her foot. And so he then, to save the kids, has to shout like that old man did. But first, he's going to sign to Reagan, I love you, I have always loved you. And that gets me in the feels.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. I don't know why she would ever doubt that he loved her because he kept giving her earpieces. Even earlier that day, she already knew that he was working on all of that. So I guess the way to take it is he should have given up on her ever hearing, because there was no indication throughout her life, her entire life, that she would ever hear. And if she didn't know that he had made that, it feels like a sequencing thing. If they hadn't done any of this stuff with the cochlear implant yet, and she didn't know that she had the weapon to hurt it, and then went down to his basement and saw all the things that he was working on, then I could understand how she would be surprised that he did actually love her. But as it is, it's just kind of a hard conflict to buy. Again, we're getting back to the same argument I've been making.
Yeah, I don't want to get into it again. There's a lot of ways they could have resolved this, made it better. We've discussed it.
Yeah, okay. So all I'm saying is I won't miss John Krasinski in the sequel. I don't care that he's dead. The three that I like, and actually I'm not crazy about Marcus, the two that I like are Reagan and Emily Blunt's Evelyn.
Let's face it, it's very easy to forget Marcus exists after this moment. After Krasinski sacrifices himself to save Marcus, what's Marcus do the rest of the movie? I honestly can't tell you where he is.
He releases the handbrake on the truck so they could roll down to the house. That's about it.
And he's holding the newborn brother. Like, he is off holding the baby.
Yeah, Emily Blunt's got to hold that shotgun, so he's got to hold the baby.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm going to say, when we get to the end, yeah, we finally figure out this cochlear implant's going to make a high-pitched sound. It's going to drive that alien crazy. It's going to open its ear so Evelyn could take that shot and kill it. And she pumps that shotgun. I'm like, all right, I'm ready for this last 10 minutes. Let's go hunt those other two. I'm down. And then the film ends. I'm like, oh, like, now I'm down for the killing scene that you've been waiting for, Stuart.
Mm-hmm. Don't you think we could have at least seen them take on the other two?
I was ready for it.
Cutting away feels cheap.
It does, and I think it also feels cheap that the kryptonite happens to be this cochlear implant. Now that they've got this, I don't feel any suspense anymore. Just hold it up and the aliens quiver and fall.
And that's why you turn it into a badass action film for the last 5 minutes where they're just shooting these things.
I gotta wonder how the second film is going to have any suspense unless they just start by saying, oh, the cochlear implant broke, and man, we wish we knew how he made that.
Well, again, they need electricity to promote the volume. It's not just the earpiece. She's gotta take it and put it against a microphone. They only have that functional microphone because they have a generator. You walk out away from this farm, you maybe don't have electricity. Find a megaphone, I guess. Find some batteries. We know they're still around. There'll be challenges, but you guys make excellent points. That seems like this is a closed circle. We don't need more because this was a story about a family processing grief. They've done it. Everyone now realizes what they should have known all along, that they all love each other and nobody blames anyone for anything. And even what seemed like a disadvantage, Reagan's hearing, ended up being the solution to all of their problems. It's very much like Signs, except they don't have to take baseball bats to glasses of water lying around conveniently.
But before we get to the sequel, let's find out, Jacob, Stuart, how strongly do you recommend A Quiet Place? Jacob.
Yeah, I think we've covered the opportunities for this film. I talked about setting up better geography so I understand where things are and where you're running around. character development. That definitely could have been improved upon. But I really like this movie. Like I said, this is one of my wife's favorite movies. I really like it, though. I wouldn't say one of my favorites, but I enjoy this one. And it's because of that gimmick where, yeah, I like how when they got to go quiet, just listening to the sounds. I don't know. That's something you usually don't get to do in a film. Just listen to how the wind is rustling through the trees. I guess unless you're watching The Happening, where that's the monster in that film. But it's just neat to focus on something different in a movie. And the fact that this is a sci-fi monster movie, there's some exciting adrenalized scenes. There is that family drama. It's not perfect. We've discussed it, but I appreciate those elevated moments in a horror movie because that's what's going to keep me interested. Not just the gore, but what does this mean for people? Like human drama, humanity in an individual, whatever. That's what I want to see in a movie, is to have that kind of core, and then you can have craziness going on around that. So I enjoy this film. The fact that it is a unique concept, well, maybe we'll debate that when we get to Bird Box, a film that's very similar that came out around the same time. But as far as movies go, it wasn't a comic book. It wasn't a sequel, even though now it is a franchise. I think this is a pretty solid film. Like, again, it's one you can watch with your kids, maybe younger teenagers. I don't know if you'd go below that, but a film about a family struggling to survive. Yeah, you brought up Hallmark movies, and it kind of works on that level. But yeah, I also enjoy the monster aspects to it and the survival aspects. So not a perfect movie, but I really enjoy just sitting down and watching this one the few times that I have. So yeah, solid recommend for me.
Stuart.
Yeah, it's easy to see why this movie stood out from the pack and crossed over to audiences that don't do horror. It is a quiet family drama that just happens to get paired with suspense and a little bit of sci-fi gimmickry that is probably the least successful part of the movie. I feel like the aliens could be removed from this. Again, cut it all out. You have ordinary people. It's four people sitting around a table feeling very sad that their youngest child died, and how are they going to process that? You know, they do it well. I just wish they had explored more of it in the second act. I do feel like, structurally speaking, I want to see the characters go deeper, change, grow. It just needed something else to happen. And I think that could have been done if you had focused from Reagan's point of view. If you had taken the risk and Krasinski hadn't directed this and made himself the focal point and the star, you could have just had the story of a girl who had all of that guilt because of what happened and couldn't hear anything. And you could have played a lot more with the sound and all of that just by focusing on Reagan. Because I do think this actress, who is deaf in real life, by the way, is fantastic and the heart of this movie. She really is a great asset, and I'm glad to see her returning along with Emily Blunt in the sequel. Maybe I'll grow to like Marcus too, and who knows about that baby, but I think he's just going to get them into a lot of trouble crying all the time. I have quibbles with this movie, but I mostly think that this movie does stay airborne. It is elevated horror that works in a meaningful, impactful way, and it's a solid recommend.
I also recommend this film. I really enjoyed it when I saw it in theaters, but I did see some holes in the cloth, you know, when I just with the plotting and things. Once you've realized the weaknesses for the aliens, I'm okay with how the aliens got here. It's convenient, but whatever, I don't give a damn. But when you find the aliens' weaknesses are they can't hear as near loud noises like a waterfall or a river, and this feedback sound makes them quibble and then we can just shoot them, I think that I would have liked a smarter ending to it. I wish there'd been something there to just make me understand why they didn't just hang out by the river the whole time. But I like these actors. And yes, Reagan, the actress who plays Reagan, is incredible in this. I like Marcus in this, the actor. I don't think the character's given enough to do, but I think that that little boy does very well in selling all the emotions when he's out with his dad and giving his dad a lesson. You know, his dad took him out to teach him how to survive, and he's teaching his dad, you know, you really need to talk to my sister.
I got a question for you, though. This movie doesn't have a whole lot of rewatchability. Like, I don't want to see this again.
And that's where I was headed, is I didn't rewatch this at all. And I watched it. I really enjoyed it. But it wasn't one I felt I needed to go back to until we said we're going to do this review. And then I'm like, good, I get to watch it again. But it's a good watch. I think watching it every few years, you know, every couple of years, I won't remember all the details until I come back. I think it's a good movie. It's definitely a really solid recommend. I don't feel like I need a sequel to it.
Yeah, it's very strange. It's not strange at all.
Made $200 million. Yeah, they want more.
Paramount Pictures. Again, yeah, it was their second biggest film of the year after Mission Impossible 6. So yes, you're making a sequel. It's probably good that Krasinski came back to write and direct, that Blunt and all the children are not so old that they can't look like it's been a couple weeks.
He didn't want to. He thought it was one and done, and Paramount's like, okay, we're making a sequel with or without you.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, it's kind of my baby. And then he said he came upon an idea that really sparked something in him that made him connect it to the material again and want to do it.
Well, here's the thing. Here's what this absolutely demands. We can't have no more moping. I know that Lee died, and that's very, very sad, but you can't have a movie with people sitting around feeling guilty. You have to expand these characters and give them more dimension and make them more than avatars of grief. And so if they can do that, then yeah, there's a whole world to explore and enjoy and have multiple sequels. But if it's just more of this and these characters are sad, no. Maybe Cillian Murphy's going to be the new baby daddy. I kind of could be.
See, I think that the sequel looks like it's going in a totally different direction. And it's really on the nose to me that Cillian Murphy's in it, because it feels to me like 28 Days Later when Cillian Murphy wakes up and it turns out the people are as bad as the rage virus monsters.
I mean, these are quotes from the trailer, so they're definitely telling you that, yes, human beings will be as threatening as the aliens, and maybe that's why they haven't been able to wipe out the aliens. There's people that want to keep them alive. We will find out, and our review of it will be out next week.
So thank you very much for your platinum donation. We really appreciate it and are so happy by going platinum. You've got weeks and weeks and weeks of shows coming. I mean, yes, there's only two A Quiet Places, but we're going to have bonus content for you platinum donors. So thank you so much for your support of our show. We hope you appreciate these thank you podcasts. So Jacob Stewart, thank you for joining me. Until next time.
Once again, thank you for supporting Now Playing, and we hope you've enjoyed this bonus movie review. It's your support that keeps Now Playing operating. The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the views of Venganza Media Incorporated. Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with, and this podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created the film analyzed herein. All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review, and no infringement is intended. Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of and may not be used without the express written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2021, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
And you know what? I'll admit, when I got impaled with the nail in my stomach and when I dropped a knife on my toe and it went in and cut, jeez, I didn't scream at either time. And I was alone in both cases, so I had nobody to scream for. You know, that's how you see birds do it, right? I mean, I think of the opening of The Partridge Family, but I also think of actually seeing families of ducks where the tallest walks ahead. And
you know, the Partridge Family is humans. They're not actually birds.
I said the opening of the Partridge Family, where they're animated birds.
I don't remember the opening of that.
Arnie's absolutely right. It's animated. And yeah, they all come out of the egg different sizes. Uh-huh. Kind of like the Brady Bunch. I mean, exactly like the Brady Bunch.
Except the Brady Bunch wasn't a cartoon opening.
They weren't birds. Yeah, I know that opening.
But they were on a stair step in height order.
Right.
Oh, true, yeah.
On paper, you'd think a movie with no sound could cease to engage, because when you watch a movie, you have really two senses going, sight and thudding.
And whatever fell over.
Yeah.
But you know why I get sucked in? Is impressive production quality and the score, the, you know, in Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Ba-da-da-ba-da-da-boom. And everything feels...
MotoGP or NASCAR.
What's wow. What was it even responding to?
Yeah, you didn't say Siri or anything.
I said, is impressive production quality and the score? And they said, which league, MotoGP or NASCAR?
What? Was that your phone?
Clearly NASCAR. Yes. Yeah.
Is impressive production quality and the score? Which league? So I think it thinks I'm asking what the score is in a race.
Yeah.
Which league? Yeah. Let's see what it says. MotoGP.
Here are the qualifiers for Valencia Grand Prix. Fabio Quartararo grabbed pole position.
That's such a ripoff. You know it should not have been him.
Yeah, I've been following this on my phone during this podcast, so.
Anyway, someone needs to put their phone away.
It was away, and it's on silent and do not disturb, but it thought I said Siri.
Well, you're dead now. I'm going to call you Bo for now on.
Until next time.
Oh, I thought you were just doing silence. I thought that was the sign off.
Oh, that sounds good. And until next time.